Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. In today's episode, we're discussing UAE's bankruptcy and financial restructuring law, and what it is and who it applies to, how it works in practice, and why, given everything happening in the world right now, this topic could not be more timely. We'll cover the legal framework, walk through the key mechanism the law provides, and address some of the most common misconceptions people have about what it actually means to be in financial difficulty in the UAE. So let's unpack this. Why does it matter, and why are we talking about this today? As we're recording this episode, it is May. Today is 1st of May of 2026. And as those of us who are based in the UAE, or in the region are well aware, the UAE is facing another round of fairly acute economic sort of turmoil and since COVID. And this is due to the recent geopolitical conflict, if you will, that is happening with our few of our neighbors, and I guess with Iran in particular, so just to be clear. So as a result of this, there's been a number of significant changes to the UAE business community, the UAE economic industry, and to just the overall, demographic of the country. And we can sort of talk about it in more detail shortly. Whatever we may think about how serious or severe this conflict is, how much or how little it may impact sort of the economy in the long run, in the short time, the effect is real, and businesses are starting to feel the pressure. So that's one, but the conflict with the regional neighbors is not the only trend or not the only event. The potential is shaking up a bit of the business dynamic and perhaps the business foundation. And we've got also the AI revolution, if you want to call it that. And that in of itself also is quite a real phenomenon. And the AI-driven automation is hitting the white-collar service work globally. We expect that the UAE and the region will not be immune from this, and perhaps even will maybe be at a forefront, because the UAE has historically been quite welcoming and progressive in terms of embracing the AI and all things digital into the way we do business and live life. So sectors highly represented in the UAE, such as customer service, administrative support, banking, back office, paralegal and legal research, medical, coding, marketing, and content roles are precisely the categories that we expect would be most exposed because of the AI revolution. So that too, that's another factor that's changing or shifting the business dynamic and the foundation, which obviously reflect on businesses, on companies, on their bottom line, and ultimately employees. Additionally, in addition to the war in Iran and the AI revolution, there are other sort of regional pressures such as tariff disputes, but perhaps affect the region less so directly, but there's still sort of the trickle down. And then there is the corporate tax implications. The UAE has embraced tax, and although it's been around for a corporate tax for a few years now, it's starting to sink in more and more as years go by. There's much more sort of increased compliance load, and also the recent recovery in commercial real estate are also squeezing margins. So the UAE businesses with receivables and in distressed regional currencies are having collection problems that they might not have had a few years back. So all of this means there's more businesses than perhaps in the last few years are asking the same questions. What are my options when I cannot pay? And that's basically what today's episode is all about. Now, let's kind of look at it a little more specifically. How does this relate to the UAE and the specific industries in the UAE? As those of us who live in this region, who have visited, or those who have visited the region, know enough about it. I mean, the UAE has a lot to offer to much of the world in terms of its appeal, tourism appeal, right? We've got tourism, hotels, leisure, entertainment. And so as a result, it's a very large part of the UAE bottom line or the UAE GDP. And so with the current situation, obviously, this is, you know, the airplanes are flying less, fewer of them. The fuel prices are going up. And so as a result, the tourism and hotel and leisure industries are directly being affected by sort of the reduction in visitors to the UAE. Similar, the aviation, travel agencies, you know, all kind of ground handling related to ultimately tourism, once again, is also being directly affected. There's a number of the airlines have suspended operations or at least curtailed operations. You know, some of the foreign airlines are not flying. So as a result, all the other kind of the ground related or ancillary businesses, such as your travel agencies, transportation car companies, limo companies, various tourist organizations and such, they're obviously all suffering as well. And we are, you know, I'm here sitting with you today talking about it from the perspective of actual our clients. We have had, since the beginning of this conflict, we've had real clients that have come to us with real problems related to these, the sort of chain of events. So this is all too real, and in particular, it feels real to perhaps, you know, somewhat smaller or sort of mid-sized companies and that are very much dependent on the monthly income, monthly revenue stream. Additionally, there's the short-term rentals and holiday homes. That's a huge industry, so part of the rental or the tourism industry in the UAE. So vacation rentals over the last several years have become quite popular, and it's become a more developed industry. And so over the last few years, you know, as compared to how it was before, it wasn't always sort of didn't always have the legal framework upon which it could exist. But by now, it's quite well established and it's very profitable, or so it used to be until recently. So, you know, short-term rentals obviously depend on tourism and tourists who come to the country for more than 2 to 3 days because they prefer to usually rent short-term accommodations, say like Airbnb, for example, or through booking.com. You know, they come for a few weeks, sometimes months, and during that time, they feed the economy further by going to restaurants, hiring these various tourist trips and or travel agencies and enjoying the overall experience. So that's also a little bit kind of slowed down as a result of current events. You know, so obviously the operators with multiple leveraged units, which we represent a few clients who are in this situation in the short-term rental space. And so they're paying annual checks to landlords on the assumption of high occupancy are now caught between fixed costs and collapsed booking pipeline. Then we've got the car rentals and the transfer services, the chauffeur services. I mean, all of these are also tied directly to tourist arrivals, and fleet financing payments do not pause when the bookings disappear. And then there's the entertainment and the F&B and retail, so such as your mall traffic, restaurant covers, and entertainment venue attendance are all visibly sort of, you know, down or lower at least than they used to be. And, you know, reports of restaurants cutting wages by 30% is quite common. And by the way, on the back of all that, the UAE and Dubai government in particular, which is very typical of the UAE government, they respond very fast. You know, so the Dubai government already announced a support package of about almost $300 million that has for sort of fee deferrals and tourism-related charge reliefs for many SMEs. This is real, and the government is taking note and is actioning to kind of assist and help businesses along the way, which, you know, the hope is for some businesses this will be a relief. This will kind of tie them over. For others, I guess time will tell. And then there is obviously the real estate and the brokerage services, and then as we mentioned earlier, the white collar services hit by AI. That's just, you know, that's a separate to the war, but it's all too real. And I anticipate the next year or so we'll see a lot more changes that are now, in addition to sort of perhaps the war kind of triggers some of these changes, and people are being kind of let go either temporarily or until for the notice, but I think with the coupled with the kind of AI changes, I think this could just be a trigger to something that was just inevitable and just a matter of time. So what does this all mean in practice is that for businesses, it's, you know, in very simple terms, is the receivables are slowing, the cash flow buffers are thinner than they look on paper. And while lease obligations and financial installments and post-dated checks fall due regardless of revenue, and that's just how it always is with businesses. So businesses that were marginally viable in 2025 are kind of sliding into difficulty. And businesses that were healthy in 2025 are getting nervous about 2026. So now what legal options do these businesses have in the UAE and how do we get there? And so many people in the UAE still, I mean, you know, I've been here long enough, but the UAE has evolved and progressed so much so quickly that sometimes I'm still surprised when I hear people's commentary about this. But I guess, you know, if looking back at the history, it hasn't really been that long. So it's not surprising that some people still may think that, you know, there's this stigma that exists in the UAE relating to anything related to financial distress, kind of and almost it's a near criminal matter, and that, you know, bankruptcy means jail, and that the only solution is basically kind of pack up bags and leave quickly, and so that impression is, you know, is out of date. It certainly did exist, and it existed for a reason, and it happened even, I remember it during my time, but it is, as we speak of it today, it is out of date. And but for the benefit and I guess some context and color in terms of how far we progressed and what you know and how you know how incredible it is that was sort of the what we have today is just kind of do a little bit of a trip down the memory lane in terms of how things used to be and how just not long ago and where we are today. And obviously that sort of the idea of this is to dispel the notion of those who still think that bankruptcy in the UAE means criminal offense or jail time, and therefore you need to run, which did happen, you know, during the shortly after the financial crisis in 2009 and 10. So that's because prior to 2016, so the UAE didn't actually have a dedicated bankruptcy law, and so there was, in fact, the sort of the stigma of the bounced check trap. And that's because at the time, before 2016, and that's, you know, from starting from the financial crisis or the global financial crisis 2008, the UAE insolvency at the time was governed by provisions buried in the federal law number 18 of 1993, which was the Code of Commercial Transactions. And there was no standalone bankruptcy law. And a bounced check at the time, just by way of example, was a criminal offense under Article 401 of the, you know, then Penal Code. And even if it bounced because of a cash flow gap, there was no fraud, it was still a criminal offense. And the checks at the time were used prolifically everywhere, kind of as security for rent, for loan installments, for trade credit, for real estate investments, for mortgages, for, you know, you name it. And so cash flow distress translated almost automatically into criminal exposure. And so the result, especially for SMEs, so the small and medium-sized companies at the time, was a recurring pattern of business owners basically leaving the country quietly when difficulties arose, the so-called kind of absconding phenomenon, because the law was not really there to provide them with any other options. And I witnessed that, so I can speak sort of from firsthand experience. So now in 2016, we were seeing in the legislative in the sort of context, we saw some changes. And for the first time, there was a standalone bankruptcy law, and that was Federal Decree Number 9 of 2016, which introduced for the first time what's called a preventive composition, which was like a formal restructuring and structured liquidation procedure. Once a debtor entered restructuring, then criminal proceedings, which still existed, so the same sort of bounce checks were still criminal, and much of the previous system had still been intact, but all of those kind of criminal implications would be paused once the sort of formal bankruptcy proceedings wouldn't be initiated through the courts under that previous law. And at the time, though, obviously, that law in particular, it signaled its intention to businesses. Failure is a commercial event with a legal solution and not so much a personal scandal with a jail risk as was before. So as I'm talking about right now, if you think about 2016, so that's 10 years ago, it's not a very long period of time. So the law we're talking about today and is yet a new law. But prior to that, I'm sure we can all recall 2020 era, and that was the COVID era. And so at the time, while there were no specific laws or legislative instruments that were introduced to add to the bankruptcy regime, but there were some emergency provisions that were being introduced by the government kind of on an ad hoc basis to sort of help with the financial crisis at the time. So the concept of the legal concept of force majeure became a lot more kind of spoken and invoked more frequently and made more of a headlines, if you will. Then it was had a big scandal in the UAE. I guess, for some it's scandal, but it's just, for in many other countries, this is a normal order of things when a business our big company fails. So in the UAE, that particular company was like Marca, and in particular, because it led to direct director liability, which is pretty scary for directors and all this senior management that ran the company. As a result, when the company was not doing well, basically filed for financial distress through the bankruptcy, under the bankruptcy law. It was, as per... as a consequence of those bankruptcy proceedings, the directors themselves personally were found liable. And that's because the courts had determined, or the trustees had determined, that the company's reserves sort of fell below what was supposed to be the 20% of the revenue company's revenues, as was sort of required by law. So just on the basis of that alone, the directors were found personally liable. So that was, obviously had risks of setting a very dangerous precedent. So the UAE had very quickly, once again, pivoted and introduced another law to kind of help ease, clarify, in particular, the liability for directors. And so that was done by virtue of a decree law number 35, 2021. Which followed basically within weeks from that Marca case to sort of clarify and calibrate the rules, ultimately stating that liability for directors exists only when there is actual intentional and fraudulent sort of proof that they tried to compromise the company or sort of harm the company and embezzled the money from the company. So something that was sort of bad faith, in other words. Then we keep moving in sort of the chronological time. So in 2022, this was a very exciting time from a legal standpoint because a lot of laws changed, were completely swept away, and new laws were introduced. So it was very, very fun time for us lawyers. But one of the big things is that finally the checks were decriminalized, and that was the federal decree number 50 in 2022 that made the most bound checks cases civil rather than criminal. And so then banks had to make partial payments where partial funds existed, for example, which was not the case before. And ultimately, the criminal liability remained, but only for genuine misconduct, like forgery or deliberate stopping the payments or balance withdrawal to defeat the check. So again, this is from starting from 2008. Now we are in 2022. A lot of while there was already a dedicated bankruptcy law, but it wasn't quite very robust. But a lot of changes were happening from a legislative standpoint to kind of bring us to where we are today. So then, in 2023, 2024, this is where the new UAE bankruptcy regime was finally introduced, and it's continuing to be sort of layered on and bolstered further as time goes on. So it started out with in 2023 with the federal decree law number 51, which came into force of 1st of May, which is the day we're recording this podcast, so exactly 2 years ago. And then afterwards, there was a cabinet resolution number 94 of 2024 that followed with implementing regulations. And that's very typical of the UAE. It will issue the main law just to set the kind of the framework. And after that, in particular, as it sort of watches how the market responds to the law, it introduces regulations and decrees to kind of further implement certain parts of the main main law or clarify or add on to the main framework. And then in 2025, just less than a year ago, there's another decision that was introduced, and it's the Federal Judicial Council decision number 39, which came into force in July of 2025, so less than a year ago, and it established a dedicated federal bankruptcy court at the Abu Dhabi Federal Court of First Instance, with branches available in other emirates as needed. So here what we've got, just kind of as a recap, in roughly 30 years, the UAE moved from like a bankruptcy as near criminal stigma to a very modern, a very sort of court-supervised framework with a specialized court. And insolvency is no longer a crime, but this is the critical point. It still is a formal court process, and we'll talk about it shortly. It's not just like a simple notice that you send to your creditors and say, sorry, cannot pay. So it's not a self-service, kind of a service exit, and we'll come back to it later. So kind of high level, where are we today? So we've got this, the legal framework, which is, once again, the Federal Decree Number 51/2023. Which is called on financial restructuring and bankruptcy, which came into force May 1st, 2024. And then there's a cabinet resolution number 94 of 2024, which is the implementary regulations of the main law. And then there's the Federal Judicial Council decision number 39 of 2025, which establishes the Federal Bankruptcy Court. So headed by a judge of Court of Appeals rank. So that's basically our legal framework now. So we started with bankruptcy. Any kind of financial distress is basically haram, as we say in Arabic. It's stigma. It's sort of considered to be kind of a blemish on one's reputation and life to a fairly robust and very sophisticated legal framework that now exists to allow businesses and companies to at least avail themselves of these tools to ultimately try to turn the corner or help them unwind the operations. More on that shortly. So at a high level, in terms of what these laws we talked about, what they represent and how they work is sort of as follows. One, the main one, is that now there's a specialized bankruptcy court. And in many countries, that's something that's existed for a while. In the UAE, it's very new. So it's less than a year. So additionally, there is what's called a registered or registry of qualified trustees and administrators. And that, too, is a very critical term. And so these are registered trustees and administrators with the relevant courts. So there's based on the courts, almost all the courts. And in the UAE, we have multiple legal systems. So there's different emirates and different legal systems. So the relevant court systems have their own trustees and administrators registered. So these are registered with the court and which are ultimately appointed for the bankruptcy proceedings. And then there's two preventive entry points before formal bankruptcy. So one is what's called a preventive settlement and restructuring. And then there's the debtor in possession management, which is subject to court oversight. And then these are just the kind of key aspects of the bankruptcy regime, right? And there's a moratorium on enforcement once proceedings open, which basically means you sort of stop any kind of liabilities or that might have been due. They basically are stopped or paused temporarily while the proceedings are ongoing. Sort of very similar to how things are in other jurisdictions where the sort of restructuring bankruptcy proceedings and the legal systems have existed longer. And then there is there's also new money financing on a super senior basis with court approval that's available. And then finally, kind of a binding plan with a crackdown on dissenting creditors. So again, this is what we're talking about. I'm trying to cram a lot of technical and legal, sort of fairly sophisticated legal principles into what is supposed to be kind of a high-level podcast or discussion. But so generally speaking, the concepts that I've just outlined, that's what comprises or what the UAE bankruptcy regime is comprised of. So there's one important comment is that this particular regime that I described applies only to the sort of onshore companies. And we have additionally two other legal systems and legal sources of law that apply separate from the UAE bankruptcy law. And that's for the DIFC, which is the Dubai International Financial Center. That's its own jurisdiction with its own DIFC courts, which are English language and presided over by judges from common law background. And so they have their own insolvency law and their own insolvency regime, and so supplemented by a number of insolvency regulations. And then there's they have their own procedures available that include and they're somewhat different from the UAE federal law. It includes, for example, receivership, administration, company voluntary arrangement, and rehabilitation. That's in the DFC regime. And they've also adopted the UNCITRAL model law on cross-border insolvency, which the onshore UAE framework does not have. And this makes the DFC useful as a kind of a conduit for cross-border restructuring. And that is a topic in itself, and I've watched a few actually interesting cases that involve the DIFC, sort of onshore businesses or onshore companies that have also involved the DIFC insolvency proceedings. Quite interesting, but it's outside the scope of today's discussion. And then, so we've got the UAE federal law or bankruptcy law, and we've got the DIFC, and we've got in Abu Dhabi, we have the equivalent sort of the DIFC, the Dubai International Financial Center. It's the Abu Dhabi Global Markets. So it's once again, but it's all its own independent legal system. It's also common law jurisdiction with its own ADGM courts, also applying English common law directly. And they've got their own insolvency regulations from 2022 and modeled very closely on the UK Insolvency Act. And so similar to the DIFC, they include administration and company voluntary arrangement, receivership, and winding up. And so they too have adopted the UNCITRAL model law on cross-border insolvency. So ADGM, quite interestingly, is maybe those who followed this topic might have noticed that the ADGM was involved, particularly in the context of a recent fairly high profile bankruptcy case in the UAE, which involved NMC Health, with around 4 billion of undisclosed debt revealed in 2020. And there was ADGM that was used sort of as a conduit for debt recovery. And so at the time, the UAE-operated entities were continued into ADGM, specifically to access the administration regime. And that was because we didn't really have our own bankruptcy law kind of on mainland that would have helped creditors in the way that ADGM had the option to help. So the bottom line is the threshold question is kind of always in terms of what regime would benefit you. Depends on where you are. So if you are a mainland company, then there would be the UAE federal law. If it is the if it's ADGM or DIFC, or if it's a foreign company, you can also sort of sometimes use ADGM or DIFCs as a conduit jurisdiction. Okay, so what does this mean in practice? So, and this is quite important discussion because, again, since this current regional conflict began, and we've had a number of clients have come forward, and it's very obvious that their view or understanding of what they think is the UAE bankruptcy law or bankruptcy regime is almost like polar opposite. On the one hand, there is still some that believe how things used to be before, that basically bankruptcy means criminal offense. You go to jail, and it's very scary, and they're genuinely sort of scared. And there's others that, you know, fast forward, kind of leapfrog, that think, now it has a bankruptcy law, which basically means we can just use that to benefit ourselves, to walk away from certain obligations and kind of set up shop elsewhere on better terms. So it's truly kind of the polar opposite views. The reality is, you know, it's obviously kind of in the middle. Most importantly, the way it works is that, so step one is it's a very formal process, right? It is done through the court. It's not just a matter of declaring bankruptcy. So if the company that wants to benefit from bankruptcy regime or the bankruptcy law, the debtor has to apply to the bankruptcy court when ultimately they are unable or to pay their obligations, or they anticipate being unable to meet their financial obligations. By the way, so that's for debtors, right? The company that's struggling. Sometimes creditors can also apply on behalf of the debtors. You know, when the debtor is defaulted, the creditors too can apply, subject to the debt threshold, provided the debt is not in dispute. So sometimes the creditor can trigger the proceedings. After that, the court, so step two is that the court opens the case, and then that becomes like a formal court proceedings, and then the court reviews whether the conditions are met, and then formally opens the proceedings, and then appoints a specialist trustee from the regulated registry that we mentioned before. These are all trustees and administrators that have previously been approved by the courts, and they are available through the court's portal. Then the bankruptcy court decisions, and this is very important. So the bankruptcy court decisions, they, for obvious reasons, they make decisions very, very quickly because this is the time is of the essence. And so, and their decisions are immediately enforceable as writs of execution. So in other words, they don't need to be served on the other party. They just immediately take effect. So for example, let's say a company has some sort of a debt or a loan repayment coming up due. And so usually the bank would cash the check or would try to withdraw money from the bank account because of automatic withdrawal. And so this is an example where the court would issue a decision which is immediately enforceable, where basically it would disallow for that money transfer, like would freeze the bank account, for example, or will stop the check would, if it's being deposited to the bank, with the court's decision, the bank will not cash the check. That's just by way of example. So then in step three is that the trustee takes over the investigation. So the court kind of basically freezes, creates the foundation for the trustee to come in and assess what's going on with the business and to ultimately figure out what's the state of the company and how the trustee can potentially assist in figuring out whether there is a way out or whether this is inevitable winding down. And so what the trustee does, and because these are, trustees are not just people from the street, they're usually accountants, and they're qualified and highly experienced professionals, so that's why they are also registered with the court as such. And so, as a result, because of their qualifications, because of their registration, they are appointed to do things such as investigate companies' books and review recent transactions, and then any kind of related parties, and ultimately also assess. And this is important: the conduct of management. And the trustee can be assisted by court-appointed experts and auditors as well, so they don't have to work alone. And in a lot of companies, size-wise, that's probably a kind of a necessary addition to their team. And then the creditors can work together with the trustee and review the trustee's actions and if need be, object to the court. So in theory, what I'm describing to you right now is basically what the law sets out in terms of the mechanism that exists for creditors in cases and for debtors in case of bankruptcy proceedings. But as I mentioned earlier, this is a very new law, and the court it's a very new court as well. So this is still, to a large extent, the work in progress, and we're watching it develop as we speak. But what I'm describing today is basically kind of the mechanism that's provided for in the law itself. And so the ultimate plan is for all of these, for the court freezing all the obligations, kind of issuing the orders, and for the trustees coming in and assessing the books and working with auditors and the experts together, is to come up with a plan. The plan where identify if the rescue is viable. And then if the rescue is viable, then the trustee works with the debtor and creditors on a plan. And then a plan is approved by the required creditor majorities and confirmed by the court, which basically binds also dissenting creditors. So because there's a majority of creditors that have to vote. So that's in the event that the rescue is viable, i.e. there is some kind of restructuring that can happen. Where the rescue is not viable, and then the court orders liquidation. So, and that's usually a kind of an orderly realization of assets and settlements of claims in priority order and distribution to creditors. So importantly, is this, these are two very separate ultimate plans and kind of takeaways. One is that if trustees can see that the business can pivot and can still be sort of salvageable, they will come up with a plan, and the plan has to be agreed with the majority of the creditors. So they work together to execute this plan to kind of ultimately infuse some new blood into the company and help it kind of survive and hopefully succeed again in the future, kind of in a new form. And if that's absolutely not possible, only then the court orders liquidation, and then that's when the same trustees then work to help kind of unwind the company's assets and sell them off and pay creditors whatever percentage on their debt. So importantly, also under the law, there's what's called a 2-year limitation period that applies to claims against directors and managers from the date of the bankruptcy declaration. And so the trustees and the creditors who want to act, they must act quickly. What this means is that, let's say, once the bankruptcy has been declared, if the trustees or creditors want to pursue directors or managers for any of the sort of repayments of what they may believe that should come from the executors directly, then they need to act within 2 years from the time that the bankruptcy was declared. So it's 2 years may seem like a long time, but it not really. So the key here is to know that there is that timeline. So if there is suspicion that somehow that some clawback may be required from managers and executives, then the trustees need to kind of reserve that right quickly. As I said earlier, so the big difference or the big options kind of takeaways or the two plans that come out of this bankruptcy law is this restructuring versus bankruptcy. So a healthy way to look at it, maybe a useful way to look at it, is compared to the U.S. proceedings. That's because in the U.S., so many, even those who don't really know what it means, I'm sure have heard terms like Chapter 11, Chapter 7, bankruptcy, liquidation. It's all kind of comes in the context of the U.S. because it's quite, that whole industry is quite prolific in the U.S. And by the way, back in the old days, even I did some bankruptcy in the U.S. And I worked in the Bay Area, the Silicon Valley. So shortly after the dot-com bust, I mean, yes, that's, they'll tell you my age. But I very well remember the kind of the bankruptcy law, the U.S. bankruptcy law at work at the time. If kind of a way of comparison, in the UAE, we have what's called a preventive settlement and restructuring, which is the rescue tools, right? So for debtors under pressure, but they're yet not quite insolvent, they're in a difficult situation, but with a valuable underlying business, right? So that's, there's still the blood is still pumping through the veins, the heart is still beating. And in such cases, in most cases, the existing management generally stays in control, and it's called the debtor in possession, right? And so, but then the moratorium pauses credit enforcement, so it allows the business some room to breathe. It stops any kind of repayment obligations or foreclosure obligations during this period of time. And then the plan binds dissenting creditors once approved by the required majorities. So this is the UAE's the UAE's plan is closest to the U.S. The most analogous to what's called the U.S. Chapter 11 reorganization. Now the bankruptcy, which is the formal proceeding, that's closest to the U.S. Chapter 7. And that's triggered when the debtor is unable to meet the obligations. Just it doesn't matter how you look at it and twist it, they just won't be able to figure out how to make sense of their business. So it's just no longer a viable concern. So the outcome is the court confirmed the reorganization or liquidation, and liquidation is, as I said, broadly comparable to the U.S. Chapter 7. So as I mentioned, kind of at a high level, if you were to compare the UAE bankruptcy law, it is very similar to kind of the architecture of the U.S. Chapter 11 and the operating kind of temperature. Just the operating temperature is a little bit different. So like U.S. Chapter 11, debtor in possession, automatic moratorium, super senior and new money financing, and cram down. But unlike U.S. Chapter 11, UAE proceedings are far more court-driven, and this is quite important because there's obviously quite a bit of misconception about that in the UAE now. And the moratorium is shorter in the UAE, typical 3 months, capped at 6. Whereas in the U.S., it sometimes can be for years. And also there's a court-appointed trustee that operates from day one rather than as an exception. So in the U.S., it's more of an exception. When you appoint a trustee, more or less, the company sort of files for, let's say, Chapter 11, and there is a formal sort of formal filing with the U.S. courts, but there's not really many external forces that are overseeing or managing these proceedings. Unlike the UAE, in the UAE from day one, the court appoints a trustee to basically a third party to oversee the reorganization. So the timing is, it matters, as I mentioned earlier, and that's, so you must kind of, those companies who are considering going through bankruptcy or some kind of reorganization, so they have to engage early because the time frame is short. So the preventive settlement, and you keep kind of more control, more flexibility, and more options if you're able to have a preventive settlement. So if you wait until the full insolvency, and then obviously you have a lot fewer options. And the law is deliberately designed to incentivize early engagement, which makes sense. So now in terms of who the law applies, and this is quite interesting, it is perhaps a little bit kind of unique to the UAE, because we've got generally bankruptcy usually means companies, right? It applies to some commercial companies incorporated and operated in the UAE, and that's kind of, that goes without saying, more or less that's what everybody expects. But it can also apply to what's called individuals with capacity of a merchant, and this is very much kind of the UAE concept. And that's entrepreneurs, sole traders, anyone who runs a commercial business professionally and habitually in their own name, right? So it's not an LLC, it's not a legal entity, sort of not a limited liability company. It's sort of, you do it kind of in your name, but you sort of a merchant, so as an individual. And then you've got licensed civil companies or of a professional nature, such as law firms, consulting practices, medical clinics, or similar. So these are the three categories that can apply or can avail themselves of this bankruptcy regime. The law does not apply to personal, family, or consumer debts. If I run out of money because I just use my credit card a little too ambitiously, and so this I cannot apply, use this particular bankruptcy law for myself. I cannot apply to like a home mortgage or personal credit card or a personal car loan. So that does not work. It also does not apply to government-owned companies or federal local because they have their own regime. That's not to say that they're not subject to, but they have subject to their own laws. Certain free zone companies are also exempt, like the DIFC or accepted ADGM. There's also other free zones like the DMC and JAFSA, so they may also have their own kind of insolvency provisions that sort of layer on onto the federal law. But there's certainly DIFC and ADGM are expressly excluded from this law. And then also banks and financial institutions and insurance companies, they're also not subject to this law because they're subject to the UAE Central Bank. And on that topic, by the way, I did a podcast on consumer protection in the banking matters in particular, and I talked a lot about the UAE Central Bank regulations and the different provisions that are available to basically individuals in distress, which is different from companies or businesses in distress, which is the subject of today's conversation. As a practical reminder, many individuals in business kind of blur the line between corporate and personal liability, especially in the UAE, happens all too often. And so a lot of businesses, shareholders, managers, they give personal guarantees and commercial obligations on personal accounts. So it'd be very clear where the line falls before a problem arises, because this is, this could be quite dangerous. So now, just kind of to perhaps delve in a little more, but without getting too nuanced, about the direct and manager liability. And this is important because, again, from just our personal experience, we've had a few requests from clients who are trying to, or at least considering or evaluating the possibility of trying to apply for bankruptcy, and because they think that they're not going to make their obligations, or they could do better elsewhere. And so this is just a reminder that you can only really apply to bankruptcy if it's genuine bankruptcy, right? If it's genuine financial distress. This is not to shield, the bankruptcy law is not designed to shield individuals, directors, executives from personal liabilities and intentional sort of fraudulent actions. So for example, and that's, you know, kind of in Marca, the Marca case, which was a big, sort of one of the big UAE companies that unfortunately fell in harder times. And so that's where the directors were held personally responsible. So after the Marca case in 2021, the rules were recalibrated. And so the 20% shortfall in assets is no longer enough on its own, as I mentioned earlier. So now the court must find the director or manager contributed to the insolvency. But it's still a fairly important threshold. So if you're thinking of, okay, I'm going to shift some money and then you know, stash it here, transfer it there, and then I can declare a bankruptcy. Well, that will be considered as sort of as intentional in or contribution to insolvency, and there is still criminal liability that's attached to those kinds of actions. So, going to ask more specific examples of contributory conduct is like disposing of assets at under value. Right, or transactions without consideration, which is very typical in these kinds of cases, or some sort of preferential payments, or failure to keep proper books, or a failure to provide information to the trustee, concealment of assets, or continuing to trade while insolvent. So any one of these sort of examples are usually considered to be contributory to insolvency and therefore can lead to criminal liability for the executives and managers and individuals that sort of make decisions for the company. And this, by the way, is another interesting concept. So the scope expanded to senior executives as well as per the 2023 law, because the 2023 law extended potential liability beyond just formal directors to managers and extended it to persons responsible for the actual management. So the very conceptual, kind of similar to the UK's shadow director doctrine and to fiduciary duty claim in the US and the Chapter 11. What that means is, and by the way, in the UAE it's quite typical, is that in many cases companies have sort of officially on paper certain managers and boards of directors and people with titles, but they're actually those people just kind of formally carry those titles, but they're not actual decision makers. There could be some other decision makers, actual decision makers that are not formally listed in the company. So now, as per the current law, the courts and the trustees will actually look at the actual decision makers, irrespective of how they're titled or not in the company's books. So even if you're not listed as a manager executive, but it's very obvious from the documentation that such and such person actually call the shots, they will be equally responsible. They'll be considered to be senior executives and the law will apply to them as well. So for these kinds of people, by the way, so what exists, the law provides, is called the clawback windows. And that's very similar to the U.S. proceedings. And that's it's 6 months for ordinary transactions before the cessation of payments. In other words, let's say if the trustees will find through the bankruptcy proceedings that such and such individuals or company made transactions for the last 6 months, payments, that is, they will be able to claw back these payments as per the new law, very similar to the U.S. And then there's also the 2 years for related party transactions. So, for example, the trustees will identify that such and such senior executives transferred funds from the company to their related parties. It could be their relatives, it could be other corporate entities that ultimately have the same UBO, ultimate beneficiary. So for these kinds of transactions, it's a 2-year clawback period. In other words, so if the trustee can find that such and such payment went to an entity a year and a half ago or a year and 11 months ago, and that entity ends up somehow being related to that shareholder or executive, then that particular payment will also be clawed back, even though it was made almost 2 years ago. And so what that means is the transactions in those windows that are unbalanced, preferential, undervalued, or otherwise harmful to the creditors can be unwound. So that's the concept. And so comparison with the U.S. is that U.S. it's called what's fraudulent conveyancing, and preference statutes typically have 90-day to 1 year look-back periods. And so the U.S., in the UAE, the related party window is longer, you know, so although the moratorium is shorter, but the looking back window is longer, so it's 2 years versus the U.S. 1 year, which, you know, surprised a lot of people, but I think that's quite notable. So just, you know, so as I said, so it's a 2 year limitation period for proceedings against directors from the date of the bankruptcy declaration. And this is, by the way, important. It's from the date that the bankruptcy was declared, not from the date that the payments were made. And this, there's some specific examples that I can share with you from recent cases, but that's, you know, so it's 2 years from the day of the declaration of the bankruptcy, not from the time that those payments were transferred. Could have been 10 years ago. There is, however, a defense for directors, and the director can avoid liability by showing, for example, they took reasonable and precautionary measures, they did not participate in the relevant acts or formally documented their objections. And this is why it's really important, and we've sort of counseled clients throughout that, you know, sometimes we're all, especially in big corporations, employees can only do what they can do. So, but as long as they document their objection and their sort of their position, that they will be able to use at least that documentation as a defense. And then there's penalties beyond the civil claims, which is important. So that's, you know, we're talking about, again, liabilities for directors and managers. So there's financial penalties up to 100,000 dirhams. There's also criminal exposure for fraudulent conduct, as I mentioned. In other words, it's not if the trustee finds out in the process or the courts find out in the process that you've transferred money on purpose and then just to kind of make the company go bankrupt. It doesn't just stop there and slap on the wrist. You will also face criminal sanctions, or if you're hiding assets, the same thing, or if you just, you know, if you fail to provide required information, also can lead to criminal sanctions. So just kind of put a little, this is a lot of legalese and a lot of sort of, thick concepts that may make a little more interesting or kind of contextualize the discussion if we go through, share some of the examples, specific examples. And these are all very public examples, so I'm not revealing anything. But, back in 2009, this is before the new bankruptcy law, or the bankruptcy law was starting to be introduced in the UAE. So there was a big, this is, you know, this just kind of shows how the UAE also, how resourceful it is, how industrious it is at that time. So we didn't have, in 2009, we didn't have the bankruptcy regime, but there were, on the back of the financial crisis, there were a lot of companies that were going through a real financial distress. Government of Dubai did is that they used the DIFC jurisdiction, and the DIFC at the time did have its own bankruptcy regime, so it used the DIFC as a jurisdiction for certain proceedings for certain companies, in particular for Dubai World and the Kiel. It set up a special tribunal at the sort of Dubai World Tribunal because the DIFC did have restructuring framework to allow the companies, actually the creditors, to work with the company to sort of figure out a plan for them to not necessarily to keep the company working and operating and still sort of assuage the creditors and work out a plan for them that would still protect their interest in the long run. So this is kind of an interesting example of how way before the bankruptcy laws were introduced, so the Dubai government used an alternative legal system that's also in Dubai, that is common law jurisdiction, to basically achieve restructuring of a company or a big business, Dubai World, which is now, if I look back at that, it's very similar to what the current UAE bankruptcy regime offers. There's the Tamwil and Amlak also had their own tribunal set up similarly. Again, this is a way until legislation changed. So this is, at least as far as Dubai government is concerned, it was very creative and resourceful in the way that it would use these special tribunals. Ultimately, using or sort of utilizing kind of the systems, this restructuring system from other regimes and other jurisdictions vis-a-vis these special tribunals set up. And then there is the more recent one is the NMC Health we talked about, and that was in 2020, so not long ago, but it's fairly the UAE's largest private healthcare provider that was listed in London there's some sort of the money there was a short sale report late 2019, and then the internal investigation that surfaced and more than $4 billion of undisclosed debt. So the UK parent went into administration, and then the UAE operating entities were continued into ADGM in 2020 to basically access its administration regime. So because again, in 2009, it was the DIFC that was used for Dubai World and Nikhil to sort of help kind of restructure. And then in 2020, it was the ADGM that was used to help kind of restructure NMC or liquidate NMC Health. So this is just an example, and then these two, Dubai World and Nikhil were ultimately sort of it's like a equivalent to the Chapter 11. They were reformed or restructured, and then in 2022, Arabtech was another kind of big company, one of the largest listed contractors in the Middle East, which is built Burj Khalifa. And then the Louvre in Abu Dhabi, but then in 2020 sort of accumulated losses over $400 million and with total liabilities over almost $3 billion. So shareholders voted to liquidate it. It's in 2020. And the Dubai courts declared Arabtech Holding and its subsidiaries bankrupt in October 2022 and dismissed the directors and appointed trustees and ordered seizure of all company assets. So here is an example of an actual company, and there was already a bankruptcy law that existed, the 2016 bankruptcy law. So that's an example of where the company was completely liquidated vis-a-vis Dubai or by the Dubai courts. And then there was another company, which is also quite a big player, is Drake & Scholl International. This was a Dubai-listed engineering contractor. And it actually used its financial reorganization committee process, the out-of-court restructuring mechanism under the bankruptcy framework, to negotiate with creditors. And that was a useful counterexample to Arabtech. So Arabtech had to close down altogether through the court here. Drake & Scholl used an alternative outside of court restructuring mechanism and basically used and to kind of negotiate with the creditors. And so kind of same broad sector and pressure, but different legal route, different outcome because they were able to actually negotiate with their creditors and kind of come out and live again, see another day. And then there was Marca, as I mentioned earlier, and that's the Dubai courts, the first instance, held that the directors and managers personally liable. That was kind of later reversed, but it triggered the change in the federal law to clarify the rules of liability. And then there was a big one, which is the Abraj Capital. That was in 2018, and it's still ongoing. That's sort of a story to itself. There's some examples of how the UAE has reacted to this. As the company back at its peak, and it was the Middle East's largest private equity firm with around like $14 billion in assets under management, and then it collapsed in 2018 after investors, including Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation, commissioned an audit of its healthcare fund, and then led to ultimate liquidation in the Cayman Islands in 2019, and then DFSA, which is Dubai Financial Services Authorities, which is the DFC regulator, it imposed its own record fines, including approximately like $315 million fines on the Baraj entities and around another $135 million on the founder personally. And then there was a number of UAE criminal proceedings, included a separate bounce checks convictions, and then there's the U.S. criminal proceedings and regulatory proceedings that continue to this day with extradition proceedings from the U.K. So the reason I'm mentioning this case is that it's just for all those who may be thinking, oh, well, we can just basically we can drive the company into distress and they're just going to walk away. And that just it doesn't work. So there's repercussions, there's liabilities, they will continue. And as Abraj shows, even since 2018, the proceedings still ongoing. So this is, I find this important to highlight because I was you know, I was sort of involved to an extent with, I've witnessed and personally watched the Abrash sort of disintegrate the seams, and I sort of helped a few on the other side, a few clients. So I know the inside information of basically how things used to be, and I see some patterns of that behavior continue. And so the idea here is that you need to understand that this is the UAE is only becoming more and more, it's a country of law, and these laws are only becoming more and more sophisticated and complex and robust. And so if you just think you can come here and kind of, you know, live a high life and then drive, you borrow money, live off somebody else's money, and then just, you know, when all the money runs out, just pack up bags and go somewhere else and do it again. That's, think again, basically. That's not an option, because not only, I mean, as the previous examples that I've mentioned show, there's so many angles that exist, not just within the UAE, but also internationally. Now the law here is such that gives the courts and the trustees and the creditors so many options to pursue individuals that hold the strings personally and be able to reach into their money, it's not a joke. So it's a serious law, and it is applied, and it will be. And I anticipate that as time goes on, the court will only apply this law even more stringently. So what I wanted to also kind of mention, and I've sort of indicated already, but I want to highlight this, is that this law is not a self-service exit, right? So I want to kind of, this is important to address, because I hear in the market quite often, and that's in some jurisdictions, you know, some people think that in some jurisdictions, well, the practical sort of playbook for struggling businesses is that, yeah, shut down the troubled entity. You know, you leave creditors with whatever is left, and then set up a new entity in the same business with the same people the next month on cleaner terms. And I tell you this from experience. We've seen that. A few clients have come our way and basically considering entertaining this very concept. This will not work in the UAE, and this is for a number of reasons, you know, as a kind of a recap of what I already said. So this is, your filing for bankruptcy does not equate to declaring bankruptcy. You don't just declare bankruptcy and walk away. You apply to the bankruptcy court, and the court controls what happens next, from accepting the application to appointing the trustee to approving any plan. And the trustee's job is what? It's just to look back, to look at all the books. And where did the assets go? Who are the related parties? What was paid in the run-up to filing? Is the new entity in substance or a continuation of the old one? So in other words, you can't just redistribute our assets before you declare bankruptcy and, you know, play ignorant that, well, look, I've got no money to pay now. Because that's the very job of the trustees, to figure out right before the filing, where was the money? What did you have in your books, and where is it now? And as I mentioned earlier, the clawback is real. So the 6 months for ordinary transactions, so the trustee will be able to go and claw back whatever payments have been made or in the preceding 6 months. And then also 2 years for the related party transactions. So for example, let's say there was some payments you had made to another entity that's your new entity right now. It doesn't look like it's not an ordinary expense. It's some other entity. It could be a repayment of a loan, for example, however you might have structured it. But so there's a 2-year clawback period. And remember, that's 2 year from the time the bankruptcy is declared, not from the time and that payment might have been made. So, by the way, the recent court decisions, which I can, if I have time, I'll mention quickly, show that the courts are willing to unwind transactions even more than 10 years old when fraud is established. So next is personal liability is real, as Marika had shown. the cases that followed afterwards, it's established that the directors who contributed to the insolvency can't personally be liable for the company's debts. So it's no joke. And then the checks, while sort of they're otherwise kind of decriminalized, but there are still limits to it. So ordinary cash flow bounces are not civil, But they're basically, they're still civil, in other words, so they're not criminal, but forgery or deliberate stop payment or balance withdrawal to defeat the check or just to have the check balance intentionally, these kinds of conducts will most likely surface around the kind of the around the time, and then they still remain criminal. And so, and most importantly, so the court, you know, there's a court-driven scrutiny to the whole proceeding. So because everything is court-supervised, the gateway into bankruptcy is also gateway into investigation. So in one, for example, in one recent Dubai case, a restaurant group bankruptcy filing led to a court of first instance to refer the matter to public prosecution for possible fraud because the court-appointed expert flagged doubts about the legitimacy of certain debts. So the system is, you know, works and it's real, so buy beware. So, you know, I guess for those who may want to understand, kind of find an analogous concept to it, to the U.S., it's sort of it's analogous to the doctrine of bad faith. So, in the U.S. courts, they dismiss Chapter 11 filings that are made in bad faith, and that's filings whose real purpose is not a reorganization, but escape from contracts or preserving insider value. So that's called bad faith doctrine. Very similar concept exists in the UAE with different language. So the UAE bankruptcy courts have kind of the equivalent instinct and expressed through somewhat different statutory mechanism, such as clawbacks and personal liability, criminal referrals, but ultimately reaches a comparable result. So the honest message is that genuine distress, use the framework, but engineer distress, do not try, because that it will not just it will not end well. It will not stop at the slap on the wrist. You can go to jail. Okay, so the takeaways. The takeaways is, for genuine distress, use the formal process. So if you are truly a company that's struggling financially and you would benefit from either reorganization or you need assistance, you need to liquidate one way or the other, then you've got a special legislative framework that you can rely on special courts and experts whose expertise you can avail to help you can unwind. So if you are in a genuine difficulty, the law gives you the real tools, use them, apply early, because preventive settlement is designed for a period before full insolvency. So if you want to still try, have a chance again, then apply early, don't wait. When you still have leverage with creditors and operational control of the business, so that would be, if you wait too long and you've lost all the trust with the creditors, you have very little chance at trying to salvage. So you can also ask the court to help restructure. This is, this is not a punishment. It's a structured negotiation under judicial supervision with a specialist trustee and the moratorium on enforcement and the binding plan at the end. So treat it as a court process from day one. Remember, it's not just simple filing, I declare bankruptcy. It's a formal filing, so behave accordingly and document very thoroughly. Disclosure also matters, and your conduct in the months before filings matters tremendously. So obviously get proper advice. The UAE has a registry of qualified bankruptcy professionals, so make sure your lawyers know the framework specifically. And do not run. So the reasons the people were leaving under the old regime does no longer apply. So running today creates more legal exposure than staying and using the framework. There was a few recent bankruptcy cases that also, I just got a high level because I'm mindful of the time. But there were, although, as I mentioned earlier, the law is new and the court is even newer. But since then, there have already been some decisions from the bankruptcy courts that have at least been publicly disclosed, where the courts, among other things, clawed back payments that were made from like 10 years back. And that's because, because these sort of, and that was by virtue of reclaiming a transfer of a plot of land, because it was transferred in 2014, which is almost 11 years ago, as a gift to an individual and then sold 2018 to a third party. But the trustee challenged both transfers, and the defense argued that the case was time barred because the transaction was registered with the Dubai Land Department more than 10 years earlier. And as I mentioned earlier, this is as per the law. The court rejected that argument because under a specific article of the bankruptcy law, And the limitation period starts from when the creditors discover sort of the fraud. You know, so when they become aware of the fraudulent act, not when the transfer was registered. So in that case, the court rely on this specific law, on this, you know, and identify this kind of as unlawful harm. And as the outcome was that both transfers were declared void, and the trustee was empowered to auction off the land worth more than, in that case, 24 million dirhams, and with proceeds going to the creditors. So the lesson in this particular case is the transfer registered with the Dubai Land Department over a decade ago, made as a gift, was still unwound when the company subsequently went bankrupt. So the clock does not start when you register the title deed. It starts when the creditors find out. There was another recent case as well, like late 2025, just recently. So also a 97 million land transfer was also voided. The court appointed bankruptcy trustee during asset tracing discovered that a plot of land had been transferred years earlier to a company with overlapping ownership, management, and premises. Surprise, surprise. A related party transaction in everything but name, which is all too typical in this part of the world. I've seen it all too often. So there was no evidence of genuine financial consideration. Again, happens all too often here. It's just people think that if you just sign a piece of paper, somehow that meets the standard. It doesn't. So if there's no evidence of genuine financial consideration, in that case, the recipient argued that there had been the mortgage in place in the time of the transfer and that it had been paid amounts to sort of lift the lien. But the court-appointed expert found no documentation of an actual purchase price and highlighted the structural and administrative sort of interconnectedness of the two entities. So the outcome there was the transfer that was worth more than 97 million was voided. And the lesson, once again, is we transfer the asset to a separate company. It does not work when two companies share ownership, management, and premises. So it's a substance over form. So what these cases tell you is that the bankruptcy court is functioning. The trustees are doing real asset tracing, and long historical transfers are being unwound where fraud is established. And the court rejects formalistic limitation defenses when the underlying conduct is fraudulent. And the court looks past corporate structure to the substance of the transaction, as one would expect these days, to ownership, management, and consideration paid. And so the framework is no longer untested. It is producing decisions that protect creditors and reverse asset shielding. So that's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website. That is lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can watch our video on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.